This is a podcast from Deutsche Welle. For more information and a selection of other programs, click on to dwworld.de.
Deutsche Welle. World in progress.
Today on the show, the challenge of disarming the population in Libya after the war.
They are obliged to keep their guns precisely for the security of their families and children. It's too early to give up the guns now.
More criticism for microcredits.
That has been a disaster. Instead of having this massive reduction in poverty and real economic development spurt, in actual fact, we've got the complete opposite.
And the struggle continues to improve working conditions for undocumented farm workers in California.
If we work about 10 hours, we should earn about $80 that day. Sometimes they only pay us $40. We're afraid to say anything because the employer may sack us.
Welcome to World in Progress. I'm Anke Rasper in Bonn. In Libya, the widely held view is that the country has solved its biggest problem, a dictatorship. But now that Muammar Gaddafi has been killed, many other problems are revealing themselves and threatening Libya's peaceful transition to democracy. The opposition is splintering with militias they once fought side by side with, but are now sparring against. Individuals with scores to settle are doing so. And the problem is that it's all being done by the gun. After a civil war that saw arms being placed in many citizens' hands, the challenge for the new Libyan government is to disarm the population. And as Don Duncan reports, it's not proving so easy.
Libyans still descend regularly to Tripoli's Martyrs Square to celebrate the toppling of Muammar Gaddafi. Fireworks explode overhead. Rebel soldiers take children on their anti-aircraft guns and spin them like an amusement ride. And stalls line the square selling revolution trinkets and comic photoshopped images of the fallen dictator.
Thank God Muammar is dead and there is no longer a trace of his awful family in this country.
That's the kind of celebratory chatter you hear all over the square. But among even this crowd, there is still a worrying sign for the future. Guns. Hundreds of thousands were given to the population to fight the country's recent civil war. And since the war, a vibrant black market has opened up, where a Kalashnikov, for example, can be bought for some 600 euros apiece, a third of its market value. With tribal conflicts and personal score settling on the rise, these same guns are quickly becoming public enemy number one in post-Gaddafi Libya. Across town, Brigade Captain Abed al-Majid heads up one of numerous Tripoli brigades tasked with getting guns out of civilian hands. Some people, al-Majid says, are willing to give up their bullets and hang on to their guns as mere mementos. But
there are others who have guns with bullets and will use them. But if they do, we will be on to them. We will arrest these people and they will be punished in court.
Tonight, they've set up a checkpoint on a busy Tripoli thoroughfare to sweep traffic for illegal guns. Those with government-issued licenses are let go, but those without face a different fate.
We have to confiscate those guns and interrogate their owners a little to see where they got them from, what they will do with them, and why they haven't given them up.
There are two main reasons people are not giving up their guns. Some say that Libya is just not secure enough yet to remain unarmed. Others, mostly former fighters like Ahmed Suleiman and his friends, are refusing to give up their guns for reasons of principle rather than pragmatism. They show me their personal arsenal in their home neighbourhood of Gorgi on a recent evening. As they clean their guns, Ahmed explains that they sacrificed so much to defeat Gaddafi, and so relinquishing their arms before the new political order is well in place is simply impossible.
I won't give them up until the Ministry of Defence releases an official declaration that everyone must give up their guns. But right now, we won't do it.
Libya has just named a new cabinet, but no such declaration has yet been issued. For now, the government forces, who number in their thousands and are spread across the entire country, can only confiscate guns they find without permits. They do not have the right to search homes or private property. What's more, the problem goes beyond rifles and handguns. In this Tripoli warehouse, run by the National Transitional Council, or NTC, the larger scale of the problem is apparent. It houses confiscated heavy artillery, rocket-propelled grenades, landmines, and even two Scud missiles. Thousands of these kinds of heavy weaponry are thought to be still at large, and that has the international community on edge. It fears Libya's stray military hardware has been smuggled to Al-Qaeda in neighbouring Algeria, or to Hamas in the Gaza Strip, via Egypt. While the NTC, together with international partners, works to curb the spread of heavy weaponry, here, at its Tripoli-based subdivision, the Tripoli Revolutionary Council, Jamal Farage and his gun control team are focusing on curbing the internal problem of armed citizens.
Our staff, you know, going around neighborhoods talking about this and, you know, like educated people, you know, regarding guns and, you know, the dangers of having guns at home and all this stuff. So it's working.
Indeed, Farage and his team collected over 1,000 arms in just a two-week period recently. But that is merely a drop in the ocean at this point. The NTC says it is very difficult to know just how many arms there are at large, but it estimates the numbers in the hundreds of thousands across the country, ranging from handguns to rifles, AK-47s, and up to anti-aircraft missiles and even chemical weapons. And by all signs, in the streets, Libyans may hang on to their guns for quite some time to come.
They are obliged to keep their guns precisely for the security of their families and children. It's too early to give up the guns now.
We don't have full security yet. It's true that people should hand in their guns, but the NTC should choose those people who can keep their guns.
All these guys with me have a gun, but they didn't bring them. We just brought one for our collective security.
Meanwhile, back at Al-Majid's barracks, there's a party, celebrating a bust, earlier that day, of an arms cache belonging to Gaddafi loyalists. While Al-Majid says he understands the fears driving those to keep guns, he's determined to overcome the gun problem, one bust at a time. And, he insists, the future is bright.
Gaddafi is dead, and the old era of Gaddafi is over, and it's a new future we have now in Libya. It's a new era, and what's more, we've created it with our own hands.
Don Duncan, Deutsche Welle, Tripoli, Libya.
While in Libya, former leader Muammar Gaddafi has been deposed, often killed, in Syria, the uprising against the Assad regime continues, and so does violence against civilians. This week, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Navi Pillay, expressed her alarm about the human rights situation in Syria and called for urgent action at an international level to stop the violence. More than 5,000 people have been killed since the demonstrations opposing the government and its brutal suppression started in March. Utilizing economic sanctions, the international community is attempting to counteract human rights violations, but many feel these attempts are half-hearted. It's hard to get verified information from within Syria, as journalists are not permitted to enter the country. In Europe, Victoria Kleber spoke with some opponents to the Syrian regime, and Brendan O'Shea presents her report.
Mohamed El's face bears a deep scar, the result of a bullet that shattered his jaw, teeth and lip. Mohamed is from Dara, a small Syrian town not far from the Jordan border. It was in this area of Bashar al-Assad in March of this year that the first uprising opposing the Syrian regime began. Mohamed was there on that fateful day, April the 22nd, when the army opened fire on demonstrators. Without any warning, soldiers fired shots into the crowds of protesters and he was shot in the face.
It was so painful and I couldn't even shout for people to help. And after that, I start to move and waving my hand to tell people that I'm injured. And people came and took me to the hospital.
In the hospital, the doctors stitched the wound, but Mohammed was forced to move on quickly, as soldiers regularly came to the hospital, often shooting the wounded and the doctors who cared for them. He initially fled to relatives in the country, then to Damascus, and finally to Cairo, where he was able to receive the medical attention he needed and where he has remained in exile ever since. Mohammed was one of the lucky ones. He escaped with his life, but many don't. Since the beginning of the uprising 8 months ago, the UN estimates that the Assad regime has killed more than 5,000 people, while Syrian opposition groups estimate the number closer to 10,000. And Syrians don't just fear being shot while participating in demonstrations. They also live in fear of being abducted and tortured. Those who've been able to escape imprisonment by the regime have reported that while they were detained, they were given no food or water and were deprived of sleep. They also gave accounts of their incarcerators gouging out eyes and extracting fingernails, while women were raped and men's anuses were burned with cigarettes. Even children were among the victims. The human rights activist Bassam Ishaq is part of the Syrian National Council, the country's largest opposition movement. He doesn't believe the crimes against humanity will stop soon. Indeed, quite the contrary.
It is getting worse. Before, demonstrations were mostly on Fridays, then they increased. Now, we have daily demonstrations and we have daily killing.
Last Sunday, Syrian troops waged battle with army defectors in one of the biggest clashes in the country's nine-month uprising, according to eyewitness accounts. Military forces reportedly stormed the town of Busra al-Hariya near the border with Jordan, with witnesses reporting machine gun fire from tanks. It's impossible to verify these accounts, as independent observers and foreign journalists cannot enter the country. As the regime in Damascus continues with full force to perpetrate crimes against its civilians, the international community remains slow and apprehensive to respond. To date, the UN Security Council has failed to condemn the atrocities in Syria. China and Russia have twice vetoed this. The first sanctions came from the US in April, and these were followed in May by the EU sanctions. Since that time, little pressure has been placed on Syria. Now, in its 10th round, the EU sanctions include an oil embargo, the freezing of assets and travel restrictions. The Arab League has too been slow to react, and it was only in mid-November that the League suspended Syria's membership and approved sanctions. Martin Beck, the director of the Konrad Adenauer Foundation office in Amman, says the international community's sanctions on Syria has had little impact.
If no one is prepared to use military intervention, then the other possibilities are limited. There is only one other option at this stage, and that is economic sanctions.
Those that support the sanctions say that if the US, EU and the Arab League were to join forces, their actions could place the regime in financial difficulties and increase pressure. It would be forced to cut the salaries of public service employees, a move that would affect around 30% of the Syrians. This could lead to more people taking to the streets to join the protests. For the Syrian National Council, the largest political opposition movement, the sanctions don't go far enough, as human rights activist Bassam Ishaq explains.
We are happy with what they did, but we are not satisfied. What we want is to provide protection for peaceful demonstrators, because if we can provide this protection, we will be encouraging others to participate.
At the beginning of this week, the UN's High Commissioner for Human Rights, Navi Pillay, expressed her alarm about reports indicating a military build-up and possible imminent crackdown in the Syrian city of Homs. Mrs. Pillay went on to call for urgent action at the international level to stop the violence before Syria plunges into sectarian violence and civil war. The UN Human Rights Office welcomed the League of Arab States' efforts to respond resolutely to the events in Syria. If military intervention was to take place, then the Syrian National Council would prefer the Arab League to lead this effort to protect civilians. Western powers could then offer their support with some sort of intervention. But to date, the Arab League has rejected any form of intervention. It stresses that Syria is not Libya and points out the resistance faced by the Assad regime is in most part peaceful. It also fears that some form of military intervention could trigger a civil war in Syria. But while the protesters remain unprotected, the killing will continue, something that greatly concerns Mohammed El.
I'm afraid about my family and my friends, but actually I believe that the regime will step down sooner or later, but I always afraid how many people will the regime kill before.
For Radio Deutsche Welle, this is Brendan O'Shea.
For almost three decades, many have seen microcredits as an effective tool to help poor people escape misery. The idea is simple. Most poor people are excluded from the financial sector because they lack collateral needed to take out a loan. But groups borrow together and they can vouch for each other, so people can start small businesses. Many donors are supporting this kind of scheme. The German government has recently published a glowing report on the benefits of microfinance in helping poor people escape poverty, empowering women and combating HIV/AIDS. German development agencies alone spend some 120 million euros on microfinance projects every year. Yet increasingly, researchers have begun to question whether microcredits are really a solution for everyone. Since poor customers have become more attractive for banks, many microlenders have ended up in debt, unable to pay back their loans. But Mohammed Yunus, who received the Nobel Prize in 2006, together with his microfinance Grameen Bank, continues to believe in the idea. Naomi Conrad reports.
I have said it many, many times that poverty should belong to museums. We should be creating poverty museums and keep them there, because it doesn't belong to human society. Human beings are capable of taking care of themselves.
Mohammed Yunus is in Zurich for a conference on social entrepreneurship, and his interview schedule is tight. But he ignores his secretary's discreet coughs as he continues to defend his brainchild, microfinance.
So far as microcredit is concerned, there is no problem in reaching out to the poorest people. If someone program is not doing it, it's because of the decision of those programs, not because it cannot be done. So to conclude, I would say that yes, it can be done, but many may not have done.
In 2006, Mohammed Yunus and the microfinance Grameen Bank he founded in Bangladesh were jointly awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. But the economist's brainchild has grown out of control and come under attack. Stories of over-indebted farmers taking their lives in India, microfinance bubbles in Bolivia and Bosnia, and extortionate interest rates are making headlines. And a study financed by the British government's Department for International Development, published in August of this year, comes to a damning conclusion. Evaluation studies of the impact of microfinance on poor people have been scant. It reads, microfinance activities and finance have absorbed a significant proportion of development resources, both in terms of finances and people. However, it remains unclear under what circumstances and for whom microfinance has been and could be of real rather than imagined benefit to poor people. The microfinance phenomenon, the report concludes, is built on foundations of sand. Milford Bateman, a British researcher based in Croatia, agrees.
I'm afraid you have to look and you have to say, well, that has been a disaster. Instead of having this massive reduction in poverty and real economic development spurt, in actual fact, we've got the complete opposite. We've had over-indebtedness. We've had far too many micro-businesses that start up and then very quickly collapse and throw the hapless individuals that got involved into much greater debt, and they lost their farms or their land or their other assets.
Part of the problem is that local economies are unable to absorb an inflation of micro-enterprises. Too many people trying to sell, say, mobile phones or baskets in the same area are unable to find enough customers to survive. But even if micro-entrepreneurs go bankrupt, they are still forced to continue paying off their loans. But that is not all.
I found many women who complained that after microfinance entered the villages, the solidarity between the neighbours deteriorated.
For his book on microfinance published this year, German journalist Gerhard Klaas interviewed women in remote villages in Bangladesh.
They have to found small groups which enabled them to receive a credit by a microfinance institution. And as soon as one woman of the group is not able to repay her installment all the others pressurize her, because the whole group has to repay regularly in order to be enabled to get another loan.
According to The Economist's class interviewed in Bangladesh, only 5 to 10% of the women taking out microloans are able to escape poverty. Some 40% are even worse off due to microcredits. However, many international donors, including the German government, still view microfinance as a cure-all, a useful tool for empowering poor people and helping them help themselves. Many microfinance institutions give loans exclusively to women, the rationale being that they are more able to assess and look after their family's needs. But Klaas believes that this preference for women has a more sinister side. A former manager of the Grameen Bank, set up by Mohammed Yunus, told the journalist that it was easier to exert pressure on women to make them repay their loans.
When something grows very fast, a lot of abuses show up. If you are making money for yourself, and we say you missed out the whole idea, this is not what we intended to do. We didn't see microcredit as an opportunity to profit personally.
Mohammed Yunus believes that it is necessary to draw up strict guidelines, a kind of microcredit certificate, so borrowers can distinguish between good and bad microfinance institutions.
I believe that human being has the innate capacity to solve its own problems. It takes time for them to figure it out, but when they're finally clear about their picture, they act.
Naomi Conrad, Deutsche Welle Radio.
For many, the holiday season is a time to gather for big meals with family and friends. But it's also a time to reflect on how that food got to our tables. In California, immigrant farm workers pick most of the state's fruits and vegetables whilst struggling to achieve better working conditions. The United Farm Workers Union estimates that about 90% of the roughly 30,000 farm workers in California are foreign-born, mostly from Mexico, and about 70% of those are undocumented immigrants. From California, reporter Max Pringle has more.
Grocery shopping is just another of those necessary chores many Californians squeeze into their busy lives during the holiday season. Few shoppers, like those at this San Francisco area grocery store, say they have time to consider how their fruit and vegetables got to the shelves.
I think the first thing people think is, how much am I going to spend? And that wins a majority of the time. I'm guilty of it. Most people I know are guilty of it.
I've never really heard anybody indicate that they cared.
I know one person that thinks about where it comes from. One. That's it.
The United Farm Workers Union estimates that about 90% of the roughly 30,000 farm workers in California are foreign-born, mostly from Mexico, and about 70% of those are undocumented immigrants. They work on farms across the state for up to 10 hours a day and in all kinds of weather, picking apples, strawberries, tomatoes, grapes, and other dinner table staples.
Plums, peaches, nectarines, and other things like that.
Regino Primitivo was a small, slightly built man of about 30, with short dark hair and an easy smile. The Mexico native has harvested all sorts of crops in California's Central Valley farm belt for 10 years. You name it, he'll pick it.
Cherries, blueberries, all of that as well.
In the summer months, when temperatures often reach 40 degrees centigrade or higher, workers can face deadly health risks.
Well, there's a heat stress, some heat stroke. You can actually go into stroke. And then ultimately, if it progresses, you can die.
Gail Bateson is executive director of WorkSafe, an Oakland, California nonprofit dedicated to eliminating workplace hazards. She says people suffering from heat illness can display a variety of symptoms.
Well, they tend to be lightheaded, dizzy. They can have stomach aches. There's a whole variety of symptoms.
When those symptoms appear, experts advise shade and water right away. Former Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger passed an emergency declaration in 2005 requiring California farms to provide shade and water once the temperature hits 85 degrees Fahrenheit, about 30 degrees centigrade. The law was in response to 6 heat-related deaths that year. 6 years on, and people are still getting sick and dying. The state has recorded 9 heat-related deaths since 2006. State health officials confirmed 1 heat-related death so far this year and are investigating 2 others. Hot days are the worst, but farm labor is strenuous all year long. Job requirements like reaching and stooping to pick crops for up to 10 hours a day make it more physically demanding than most jobs.
Literally more backbreaking, not figuratively, literally more backbreaking.
Frank Bardicky is a labor historian and author of Trampling Out the Vintage, Cesar Chavez and the Two Souls of the United Farm Workers. It's a history of the struggle in the 1960s and 70s to unionize farm labor in California, led by the late labor activist Cesar Chavez.
People make about $10 or $11 an hour, but at very, very hard work. This is work that's bent over all day long.
Norma Ventura is with California Rural Legal Assistance in Fresno, California. It's a group working to protect farm workers' legal rights. She says workers are paid by the amount they pick, and many of them feel pressured to risk their health to increase their production.
A lot of them are working by piece rate. So it's however many boxes you make in one day or however many trays you produce in one day, that's what you're going to get paid for.
Ventura says in recent years, many indigenous Mexican migrants have been arriving in California's fields, which poses a whole new set of challenges for educating those workers on safety and labor rights.
So they speak other languages, Mixteco, Zapoteco, Triqui. And so a lot of these trainings are given in Spanish, mostly in Spanish. And we still have a lot of farm workers that don't speak Spanish fluently.
Workers say they also have to deal with some employers' dodgy accounting practices. Again, Regino Primitivo.
Si nos pagaran por horas y hacemos unos...
If we work about 10 hours, we should earn about $80 that day. Sometimes they only pay us $40, $50, or $60. We're afraid to say anything because the employer may sack us or replace us.
The United Farm Workers Union, or UFW, says unionizing the workers will give them a voice on the job. But the itinerant and seasonal nature of the work forces workers to move around following the harvest. The UFW's Armando Alenis says the constant moving around and most of the workers' off-the-books immigration status makes organizing difficult.
A workforce that everybody knows is 70%, 80% undocumented. A workforce that has no job security whatsoever.
He says only more worker involvement in determining their own working conditions will make a real difference in minimizing the number of illnesses and fatalities in the fields.
Until workers feel that they have the support, until workers have a real voice on the job, these conditions will continue.
And there have been some recent legislative successes. In October, California Governor Jerry Brown signed SB 126, a bill which directs the Agricultural Labor Relations Board to certify the union on farms where evidence is found that the employer interfered with a union election. The law is a compromise based on a proposed bill which would have certified the union where a majority of employees signed cards in favor of unionizing. The farming industry mostly opposed it, saying it took away workers' rights to a secret ballot election. The new law is only a start in helping to improve working conditions for farm workers. Meanwhile, winter squash, cabbage, and cauliflower still need harvesting this month, and the workers go on stooping to pick those crops, doing what it takes to feed families, theirs, and all the families of California. For the World in Progress, I'm Max Pringle.
And this report about undocumented farm workers in California wraps up today's edition of World in Progress. Thanks for tuning in today. For more information on development topics, or if you want to listen to these and other reports again, please check out our webpage at dw-world.de/development. Thanks for joining me today. On behalf of the studio team here in Bonn, Eliane Giaducci and Mike Eckhart, I'm Anke Rasper saying goodbye.
Siento frío, lloro.
You've been listening to a podcast from Deutsche Welle. We hope you enjoyed the program. You'll find more information and podcasts at dwworld.de.